Welcome to the Addiction Psychologist Podcast, brought to you by the Society of Addiction Psychology. Today on the Addiction Psychologist Podcast, we're going to be speaking to Dr. Ayanna Jordan. Ayanna is an assistant professor in the Department of Psychiatry at Yale University School of Medicine. She also is the Associate Residency Program Director there as well. And she's an addiction psychiatrist and an attending psychiatrist at Connecticut Mental Health Center. Ayanna has spent a lot of her time doing research and doing practice on the social determinants of health. And today she's going to be talking a lot about the opioid epidemic and substance use more generally among Black populations, and especially the intersection between racism and substance use in America. Ayanna, we are really excited to have you on. Thank you for joining us.
Yes, it is really my pleasure. I have been looking forward to being on the Addiction Psychologist Podcast. I saw the little teaser on Twitter, and I said, wow, people are really waiting to hear from us today. So happy to be here, and let's get into it. What are we going to talk about, guys? Let's do it.
Well, we're gonna talk about all kinds of stuff. Some of the great work you're doing, and some of the problems with our field. But before we get into that, I want to hear about your training a little bit, sort of how you got to where you're at.
Yeah, no, for sure. And I think it's important to start from the beginning, because who I am and the work that I'm doing now did not look like what I was doing when I first started out in terms of my training. And I think that's important to folks who may think like, do I have to continue on this particular path if you don't love it? And the answer is no. Take risks and be bold and be courageous in terms of really doing something that honors you, that you feel valued and you're particularly passionate about. So all that being said, I started out knowing that I was going to go to a historically Black college and university. And that is really important just because both of my parents went to HBCUs. And also growing up in Pittsburgh, which is a really racist city, although I have a lot of like love for my city for sure. Shout out to the Black and Yellow forever. But it really is a very segregated city, not a particularly diverse city. There's Black and white, but you know, people, it's not unlike a lot of cities of that size, just there's not a lot of integration in terms of Black and white folks. So it was really important to me when I got out of high school to go to a place where everyone would look like me for the most part and not necessarily have the same kind of upbringing, because, you know, Black people are heterogeneous, but that I could feel safe, right? Nobody would call me the N-word. No one would say, you know, they're going to hang me from a tree, go back home, ugly Black gorilla. These are all things that I heard growing up. So I know I'm being a little bit long in terms of my training, but I think it's important so you understand like why foundationally going to a historically Black college and university was essential. And that is when I fell in love with science, because Dr. Penn Marshall, and God bless her, she's still alive today, is a badass Black woman. She was one of my mentors at Hampton. That's where I ended up going, in Hampton, Virginia, who was a single mom, had three children, and was an amazing biologist, PhD. And I saw myself in her, and she really encouraged my love of science. And she said, Ayanna, you know, what do you want to do? And I wasn't really sure, but she encouraged me to be very unapologetic in expanding what a Black woman could do with science. And because of her existence, that gave me the courage to apply to MD-PhD program. So Anywho, and that's another thing. Like, I didn't even know MD, PhD things existed. Who knew? Like, I didn't know that was a thing,
I had no
right?
idea.
Right.
Could you talk a little bit
Yeah.
about that? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm a woman of a certain age, although I'm still cool and very hip and young. But,
Obviously.
I'm not a millennial. And so the reality is that when I was going to Hampton, the pre-medical track or the biological track was really like dental, pharmacy, med school, PhD. Like those were the choices, right? Maybe engineering, maybe math, but there was not much information in terms of what else you can do. And Dr. Penn Marshall said, "Ayana, you have an amazing way with people, and yet you are so passionate about science, thinking about combining those two programs." But again, I was like, "What are you talking about, girl? Like, who's going to school for 7 or 8 years? Like, not me, you know?"
Jokes on all of us, yeah.
Exactly. So anyway, she is the one who gave me information about the what is it, post-bac program at the National Institutes of Health to give me a little bit of time to learn more about the MD PhD, because I was really torn. I was torn between med school, pursuing a PhD, and then when I found out that there were these NIH funded like medical scientist training programs where you could do both, that allowed me just the space to be able to learn more about it. And so I think that's like a pearl, like wisdom, because I was like, oh, I have to go straight through. And it's like, no, you don't, right? And allowing that time for me to go to NIH and like work with Ed Berger, who's a rock star, he's now retired. He was one of the men who discovered the receptor that HIV uses to infect T cells.
Wow.
So, like, I was working with some amazing folks,
That's
right?
unreal. Yeah.
Yeah, it was totally unreal. And at NIH, I talked with Bert Shapiro at the time, was the guy who funded, who was in charge of all of the MD PhD programs in the nation that were funded by NIH. And so here I was talking to him. What do you think would be a good fit? Where do you think I should go? And long story short, I ended up at the best place on earth, New York City, to pursue my MD PhD. What is the saying, guys? Help me, like, youth is wasted on the young. Is that it?
Yeah, that's absolutely it.
That's it.
Mm-mm-mm.
So true.
So true.
Yeah.
Like, I had no idea, like, the trials and tribulations of doing an MD PhD in New York City. Like, so much stuff happened. The crash of our whole economy, the blackout, like it was a wild time, a wild ride. So anyhow, Einstein is where I really came into my own. Like I grew up, I always say like I became a woman, not in like not in like the way of like I lost my virginity, nothing like that. In the way of really dealing with adversity for the first time in a way that I had never experienced from before, really seeing poverty in this country in a way that I hadn't experienced before, training in the South Bronx, and really wrestling with, at that time, we didn't call it the social determinants of health, but like true inequities. And I'll tell you, like, I was like, at that time, working in a lab, all of my work, up to that point was in immunology. I got my PhD in immunopathology, but I didn't love it. Like I liked it, but I didn't love it. I was like, am I going to spend my whole life like sacrificing mice and extracting regulatory T cells, which is like, shout out, I developed that technique, how to get the most regulatory T cells out of mice, but it's like, that's not my calling, right? And that was the first branch point where I had to, and this is what I'm saying, it's like I became a woman. I had to say, okay, Ayana, you have had so many mentors in this particular area, so many people who have contributed to who you are, your career, but is this really what you want to do? And I knew that it wasn't. And through my own experience with a clinical psychologist, shout out to Dr. Cabot. She helped me to be brave and chart a new path in terms of not throwing away all of the training that I had done during the PhD process, but using that training to inform how to pursue a career in health equity. And so that's kind of how I got to the place where I am now. After I finished up the MD PhD, and I knew I was going to do psychiatry because it was just not a lot of culturally informed care. It was like, what are these people doing? All of the psychiatrists Seriously. Were white, all of the patients, the unit were Latinx, and there was just a huge disconnect. And there was not a way for the patients to actually hear what the providers were recommending in a way that spoke to their spirit. And I was like, I think I can do this better, you know? So that's how I got into psychiatry. And then I said, why would I leave New York City? Like, New York City is the best. But my mentor in New York, he trained in Yale. So he said, Ayanna, go and apply to Yale. Guess what, guys? I didn't apply to Yale at first.
Why not?
Because who cares? Like, I didn't care. I was like, I'm in New York. Why am I going to New Haven? Like, I didn't grow up going to any Ivies.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The importance of that was lost on me. Like, I genuinely didn't care. And truth be told, I really don't care now, you know? So I'm like, I want to just be in a place where I can take care of people who have been marginalized other. And I didn't know anything about New Haven, but Lord knows New Haven has a lot of work to do. So.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Dr. Levine came to me. He said, Ayanna, I know you didn't apply at Yale because anyway, long story short, I said, okay, let me add Yale to my ERAS. And I did. And it wasn't the interview at Yale that I love, because I can tell you, when I got to Yale and I interviewed, I walked into this room. There was nothing but white men. All of my interviews, none of them were Black. I'm like, y'all know y'all interviewing a Black woman. Like, y'all couldn't find one token Black person there? Ugh, gosh.
So what was it?
Yeah, exactly, because it wasn't that interview there. And this is before they were whining and dining people, so I just had a bag lunch and some chips, so it wasn't the food. Shout out to David Nestico at Yale now, who just organizes just amazing dinners and stuff. What it was is, don't laugh at me, guys, but this is the truth. This is
a judgment-free zone. This is a judgment-free zone.
No, don't laugh. So
you're building such suspense. I want to know.
Yeah. Okay. What happened was, at the time I was single, and I asked one of my interviewers, who's a white Jewish man, like, if I really come here, how am I going to find, where are all the Black single men? And he looked at me very thoughtfully and was like, you know, I don't know, but I will find out who can help you, and sent me the most thoughtful email and was like, these are some groups that you can get involved with. These are some activities. These are some people who may know. So the kindness and the thoughtfulness showed me that they were really trying, you know, to create a space, and they were willing to take a chance on me, someone who at this point in my career wanted to pursue a totally different path in terms of my research and my clinical interests. So the openness of Yale to really be accepting of all the different experiences I had in my training was why I ended up choosing Yale. And I'm so grateful, because people have been immensely kind. So that's my training, much longer than we anticipated, but that's kind of how I got from there to here. You know?
No, I love that. I think it was really important to hear that perspective, and especially going into what we will discuss. But I also want to comment on, like, your openness to meet them where they were at the time, right, too, I think.
Right.
That's
so true.
Yeah, that's really cool. I,
I can't believe you thought we would laugh at that.
Well, that's just real.
I'm like,
that's just real. I think it really. Yeah. I'm really actually. I just want to make sure that it doesn't just blow past us right here about how important it is to be a whole person in your training and to think not just about how I can get these letters behind my name or these pubs on my CV or these lines on these papers, but instead about how I can live my life in a way that allows me to show up the way I want to be the type of professional and human that I want to be. Can that happen here? Right. And that,
listen, you are preaching and all I can say is Ashe, brother, like I hear you, I feel you, and you are speaking truth to power because, you know, it's just so important, right? And like, I'm realizing that so much now during the time of the Rona and anti-Black racism in a way that I've never experienced it before, like the importance of showing up, having a community that can support you and being your whole self. I had no idea how important it would be, for sure. That's another pearl for sure.
Yeah, that's been a big reveal, I think, for a lot of people who may have not thought about it just based on the shifting sands of our country today and all the things that are going on. And for me, there was very few things that were more transformative than coming to that realization in my training and thinking about how my training, how I can leverage my training to be able to show up and show out the way I want to. As a professional, as in my personal life, and all of those things. And so I'm really glad that you brought that up, because I think that's a message that can get lost in the shuffle when we're talking about accomplishments. Like, people are so much more than the lines on their CV, right? It's the synergistic effects of their background and their value set and their connection with their community in concert, right, with their academic prowess and their ability to be able to do great science or great clinical work that allows us to really, I think, maximize all of the stuff that we can bring to the table.
No, for sure. I mean, I can't say it any better. Yeah. So, you know, I'm grateful, right? And that goes to the point of, we'll talk, hopefully we'll touch on a little bit later, is the importance of mentorship, right? So like, my mentor could see and knew that I would be nurtured in a place, and Yale would be open to that, nurturing the whole self. And I didn't know it, right? And so I think having amazing people around you who understand your spirit, understand your value set, and then kind of lead you on the right path is important. And being open to new experiences, because I thought I had, you know, done, seen everything that I need to see in New York City. So I was like, New Haven, who? Like, who cares, right? But
yeah. And it was that great mentorship, right, that allowed you to shift gears a bit from, right, like T-cell measurement and like all this stuff to like a totally different.
That's really a language we don't speak.
Right, I mean, right. And so I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your research and your work as an addiction psychiatrist.
Yeah, thank you so much. Well, guys, I love what I do. I mean, I genuinely love what I do. And so to God be the glory for that. I'm a very spiritual person, and I'm really grateful to be able to, even during this time, have a love for what I do. So the way that I describe my work is really simple. My whole mission is to restore humanity to people who have been marginalized, othered, and made to feel devalued, right? And so what that means is that I work with people who have addiction issues, mainly substance use disorders, and have another identity in terms of being historically excluded from this country, usually racial and ethnic minority groups and sexual and gender minorities. And so all of my work really does think critically, how can we be respectful of one's humanity in the field of addiction? How can we provide access to evidence-based treatment in a way that is culturally affirming? How can I teach other mental health providers and addiction specialists how to maximize their skill set so they can best take care of these marginalized folks? And what is the scholarship that needs to be created in order for folks to be able to read and say, I can do this, or this has changed my understanding about a particular a subject. So that's what I do. I spend the majority of my time, probably 60%, developing the Jordan Wellness Collective. And that's the name of my group. I don't like to call it a lab because the people in which I really interface with don't really accept that language because they don't want to feel like they're being experimented on or you know, people are trying things on them. So it's the Jordan Wellness Collective. And the main mission of that is to increase access to evidence-based treatment for people with substance use disorders, racial and ethnic minorities. I focus a lot on establishing synergy between traditional settings of care and faith-based organizations. So that's the majority of my time. I spend about 20% taking care of folks, taking care of patients. And one good thing is when I am in clinic, I am busy because people know Dr. Jordan is going to do the best job to treat you with the utmost respect in the way that's culturally affirming. And I teach my residents how to do that. And so I spend a lot of time, not a lot of time, but the time that I spend in clinic is all focused on teaching residents and making sure I take best care of patients. But I can tell you, I'm learning more and more as I get older and more established in my research in the Jordan Wellness Collective. Like, I have to be able to create systems of care. Like, no matter how many people I see one-on-one, that's not going to change how people who are other receive care, like in Boston, right? Or yeah, in the Midwest or in the West Coast. So like, I want to really go hard in the paint. I don't know if you guys know what that means, but I'm trying to do all that I can to develop systems of care. Yeah. And then I spent some time in training, right? So I'm one of the associate residency program directors at Yale and want to do all that I can to make sure that Black and Brown people know that you are welcome in this field. Your perspective matters, right? And you're a doctor, and this is what a doctor looks like, right? Somebody who has this African rap or however you want to show up, you can show up. So shout out to psychiatry and addiction psychiatry because it allows me to wear all these hats, right, and get a paycheck for it. So I'm grateful.
Seriously.
Yeah, absolutely.
Samuel's laughing. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, I hear you saying that, you know, your work sort of focuses on, just the whole gamut from training to individual interactions to systemic changes, right? Mm-hmm. And I want to get around to some of the stuff you mentioned, the connection between religious groups and treatment programs. I know that you recently presented at the recovery kickoff some information about a pilot study you've done, and also the Imani breakthrough. I want to hear about some initiatives that you got going on. Before we get into that, I want to talk a little bit about, you know, there's the historically excluded groups that you mentioned and that you've focused on, but you know, substance use has sort of a history of being particularly problematic for that group and sort of being soaked in racism. And I want to talk a little bit about that with you, and maybe specifically in the context of opioids.
Yeah, I mean, God, so much to say, and I think one of the things is that the field just has to be honest with is racist history, right? Yeah. Racist historical legacies that have contributed to the disproportionate amount of burden that fall on Black people especially, but also Indigenous people and Latinx people who who have substance use disorders. And I think one of the most glaring examples of the racist legacy with an addiction is the war on drugs.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Seriously. So talk about structural racism. I mean, the president of the United States actually doubled down on policies that he knew, and I'm speaking about Nixon, right, would systematically disadvantage Black and Brown people, because he genuinely saw them as super predators. We heard that language before.
Right.
Saw them as the root of evil in terms of ruining communities, totally ignoring whole segments of society, i.e. white people who use substances, right?
Right.
And did not have any compassion or empathy for communities of color to see that these are folks who need access to treatment, right? As opposed to punishment.
Right.
Yeah. And because of this really, and we can go into all the different policies. That's a whole nother podcast, because I actually give lectures on all the different policies from the 60s and 70s that have really contributed to the two-tier system of addiction. Now, shout out to the Social Justice and Health Equity curriculum. We have a whole history of psychiatry track where we go through that. But the point is, developing an entire program, putting millions of dollars towards the war on drugs, so that people who looked like me were more likely to be sent to prison as a result of their substance use, as opposed to receive treatment. And the sequelae of that, of those actions, because Reagan came to, and doubled down on the war on drugs and all the policies that were instated at that time, Reagan came and doubled down on those and made the situation even worse. So the long-term sequelae are still being felt to this day. And one of the reasons that I talk a lot about opioids is because what I'm seeing is there still is no compassion for Black people who use opioids. And we see that even in our addiction medical specialties. So let me give you an example. When the nation started to grapple with white people becoming addicted to prescription pills at the time, oxycodone, OxyContin, you know, everybody talked about, oh my gosh, this is the opiate crisis. What are we going to do? Mainstream media covered it. I mean, you really thought we were in the midst of a crisis in terms of the numbers, right? But there was no deliberate coverage of the indigenous people who had higher numbers of opioid-related deaths at the same time. I mean, like, look it up. You don't have to believe Dr. Jordan. It's SAMHSA data, right? There was still, and there's still to this day, no coverage of how hard hit indigenous people have been at, in the midst of this crisis, right? A total erasure of their existence. Same thing. So now we know that Black people outpace opioid overdose deaths when compared to white folks. That's not being covered. So again, why is that the case, right? Why do we see increasing numbers for Latinx population, 118% in terms of the increased rate of opioid overdose death compared with white, for Black people, it's 140% in terms of the increased rate, largely due to fentanyl. That's not covered in the larger media. People are not even teaching this within the addiction medicine, addiction psychiatry fellowships. So this is what angers me, because I have to go so hard for Black people, because I'm like, do we not have value? Why don't we have any compassion? When folks in Harlem in the 60s and 70s were addicted to heroin,
right,
Yeah.
We were getting locked up. Literally getting locked up.
Right. And so the narrative
back home
has sort of shifted because.
Right. Because it's white folks.
White face. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's white folks. And now the nation says, okay, there are a lot more caring lenses towards, more of a caring lens towards opioid addiction because it is white facing. And that really angers people like me because it's like, can we get to a point in society where everyone, no matter how you look, has value? And we're not there yet because it's still happening. Again, African-Americans outpace whites in opioid-involved overdoses. That is not being covered.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a really important piece is that think about the message, the implicit message or explicit message, depending on who it's landing on, that
right. We
don't care about it until it has a white face on it.
Right.
Like think about that for indigenous communities, right? Or Black communities in America, right? They're like very explicit message, well-received by us, right? Like I hear what you're saying, right? It isn't until a soccer mom in Ohio got a back injury and then she picked up a prescription and now she's has an addiction that we're like, oh, we need to do something.
Right.
When there's been systematic things set in place for generations, right? Mm-hmm. To disadvantage communities of color in this way.
And not only disadvantage, but to systematically go after, right?
Yeah,
the over-policing, target. Thank you. So it's like, very deliberate in the ways in which communities have been totally destroyed by the war on drugs, right? So it's not just happenstance. It genuinely is having a budget for more police in Black areas to target people who are using substances. And I think the other thing that we have to remember too is like, there are all types of negative ramifications for having involvement in the carceral system, right? So in certain places, it's difficult to vote. You can't just go and rent because of your involvement in the jail system. It's hard to get a job. So like all of this affects, you know, how people are able to even take care of themselves, take care of their families, establish recovery. So that's what we talk about in the Imani Breakthrough Project. So I'd like to talk a little bit about that if that's okay.
Please do.
Because we understand that so many of our folks have been targeted because of their heroin use. And so the whole focus of it is to really say, Black and Latinx people, we love you. We're affirming of who you are. We value you. We do that within the church community and the way where they already have inherent trust, all led by people who look like them. The basis of the groups that we do in the church are evidence-based off a citizen's manual that was developed at Yale. It said, what are the 5 R's that are needed to be a citizen in society? Rights, relationships, resources. Okay, what are the 5 R's? Okay, I'll get back to them because I'm forgetting some R's. But what are the 5 R's needed to establish citizenship in a community? And with people with serious mental illness, they found that when people completed those groups over 12 weeks, they found that not only were they less likely to have psychiatric symptoms, but they also decreased their substance use significantly. Mm. So we use those classes as a way to affirm someone's identity in terms of their minoritized group and say that we care about you, even though the world doesn't value you, we do. Let's learn about all the different ways in which you can establish citizenship. And so part of the classes, and all of these are done in the church, we talk about things like the impact of racism on someone's thoughts and feelings, right? How does that lead to increased use? How do we identify triggers related to police brutality, mm-hmm. right? And we go through that, but at the same time, we encourage them to interface with the traditional setting of addiction treatment, and we allow them to do that in the safety of someone who looks like them, who's in recovery themselves. So everyone is identified with a peer recovery coach who has been with them the entire time while they're having the groups based on the citizens model in the church. And then when they go to their appointments, let it be maybe at an opioid treatment program because they're on methadone, or at an addiction clinic because they're getting MAP, they accompany through them. You're doing great. So sorry there are no pictures that look like you on the wall. So sorry that you have to wait for a whole hour to talk with your physician, but you can do this, right? And so that's basically the gist of Imani. And at the same time, when they get done with the first 12 weeks, we have a second 12 weeks where we just focus on, all while they're still in traditional treatment, we focus on what? The social determinants of health. So we say, what are the vulnerabilities you're experiencing? Okay, you don't have a job. You don't know how to read. Oh, you know, you've been kicked out of the shelter because you don't have an ID. Whatever it is, again, we have wraparound services to help shepherd that person through, right? Because we know that in order for somebody to establish and stay in recovery, like we talked about when we were saying about the whole self in the beginning of finding a graduate program, we know we have to attend to the whole self. So it's not just about getting on methadone for your opioid use disorder, but it's also about making sure that you have the ability to read, because maybe you had to drop out in the eighth grade, or working with a legal medical partnership to expunge something from your record just because you didn't, because that's preventing you from getting a job. I mean, these are the things we do with Imani. And most important is everybody that's involved is from a Black or Latinx background. So all our peer recovery coaches, all of the group leaders that are doing the citizens manual in the churches, the PIs are both Black women, myself and Sherelle Bellamy. Shout out to Black women who are always holding it down. So all of these things are important in terms of who has value. Remember, we were talking about now people have value because the opioid epidemic has been shown as white facing. We say you have value as a person in your Black or brown skin.
Yeah.
So that's revolutionary.
Yeah. I love that. And I love in particular that it's in an environment that the people are comfortable with, but it's also like establishing community and culture. I've been thinking a lot about and doing a lot of reading about substance use among Indigenous populations and you know, reading about the history of just how you know, white colonials and even up until this day, really, like with the pipeline and whatnot, but have systematically sort of taken away communities. Child welfare acts, like literally destroying the culture of these groups of people. And I think that's a critical component about some of this, is reestablishing identity and culture.
Thank you. Preach. Yes, exactly. This is a core part of the treatment, and that's what we have to understand. Our communities of color have been systematically attacked.
Yeah.
Like you said, through policy.
Yeah.
And so how can we restore your faith in your own identity and to who you are? How can we start to put together the pieces in terms of what a family even looks like again, you know?
Yeah.
Seriously. I think it's all of those things, right? Like that part of, right, like the history of America, it's in the DNA of America, right? Is to strip away the culture, right, of Indigenous communities, of the Black community, right? Latinx community, all of these different communities, you know, to create a power structure specifically that works the way it's supposed to this day.
Right.
And that in order for these communities, right, to regain power, one of the first things we do is we have to reconnect them with the the rich tapestry that is their culture, mm-hmm. that is their community, mm-hmm. and then create mm-hmm. systems to help them. John Kelly says it in a way where it's like individuals need to have, they're building a life, you need building permits. And yeah, the system is designed right. to keep these people from getting permits, right? Like I can't lease an yeah. apartment if I got a felony for like a small amount of cannabis.
Right.
What?
Oh, yeah. Right? Like, yeah.
What?
Yeah. yeah.
Right. And that doesn't just like wash off in a couple of years.
No.
Like, that's hanging out with you. That's a permanent thing I have to deal right. with. Yeah. Right. Well, I can't get into higher education, right? Because of these types of things, right? And so all of the levers of power are designed to keep people from getting building permits so that the life and communities don't get built. And right. so a program like this is just such a breakthrough from my vantage point because it leans right into it, right? It's talking about like, we got to build this community. We have to create a system by which to allow people to build lives that are meaningful and connected with community stakeholders involved from day one.
Yes.
Right? And yes. training individuals who live in these communities to be here so yes. that when people leave, because they leave, right? Mm-hmm. Researchers, things mm-hmm. like that historically have helicoptered in and helicoptered yeah. out. And so yeah. we got to leave, right? Like you talked about when you're training programs at Yale, right? Mm-hmm. Like leave behind things that are going to stick around past your
yes.
like, lifetime, right? Right? When we go, whether that's due to death, right, or moving, right? A lot of times we got to move because of our jobs and stuff.
Right, that, right. That
these systems are going to be self-sustaining, right, yeah. and affirming.
Yeah. And
so I really just want to make sure that that all of the work that you're doing here is just getting the type of credit it deserves because it is so meaningful.
No, I appreciate that, brother, for real, because it's just like, that's what we're trying to do. And I think that is really at the heart of Jordan Wellness Collective is putting really CBPR, community-based participatory research, putting yep. back the power to the people who exactly. are going to be sticking around. This is their community. This is their environment. Some folks have lived in the areas where we're working longer than I've been alive, truly.
Yep. Yep. So, those are experts right there. Yeah, right.
Those are the right. experts.
Those are the experts. Sure
that they have access to the resources that they need to take care of themselves. Yeah. So I just want to, let me do the five R's because I'm like, if I don't remember, roles,
do
resources, responsibilities, relationships, and rights. Those are the things, the five R's that are needed to establish recovery. So we go through all of those. It's really an awesome program. And at the end of the 6 months, and we call it a program, not a research project, again, because that was the name that the community members wanted to use. And I'm very deliberate in terms of nomenclature. But at the end of Imani, what is so awesome is that there is a graduation, right? And so, I mean, guys, like we're very privileged because, like, you know, we have terminal degrees, yeah. you know? And you got some folks who genuinely have never been celebrated for anything in their life. And I'm not even being I'm not exaggerating in any way. And so having a graduation at the end of 6 months is a huge honor when you're having the whole community of folks that were rooting for you come to the church setting, feed you, give you a certificate, all of these things to say you did it. That means a lot for their identity amongst a sea where they're never valued. They're not seen because they're not associated with whiteness or they don't have approximation to Yale or, you know, whatever,
yeah.
you know.
Yeah.
So it's a big deal. And I'm so proud and, you know, we just put in a grant to NIH to study the long-term effects of Imani Breakthrough compared to traditional settings of care for addiction. And I hope it gets funded because it's such an important revolutionary way of thinking about providing addiction care, for yeah, sure.
Absolutely. I don't know if our podcast has reached NIH yet, but if anyone is listening from NIH,
it may fund it.
It's, yeah. it's very important.
There's at least somebody from study section.
Yeah, right. Somebody from listening. Study section. Exactly. And while I say that, I'll just say shout out to George Koop for sure, who's the director of NIAAA, because he did just fund my R1, which is another study. So I am officially a NIH funded researcher. Woo!
Wow. So exciting. Can you tell us a little bit about that R01?
I can gladly. Guys, I got my NOA. You would think I was balling. Like, that's none of my money. That is all going to go to the community. But what a awesome accomplishment. And I really do mean that, because we know that less than 1% of researchers who receive an R are Black. So that it's a big deal, right? And in all seriousness, that's not lost on me. And when I found out, shout out to my project officer, Deidre Roach, I literally bawled because I was so excited for the culture.
Right.
So this is a different project, a little bit of a different kind of philosophy than Imani. Imani is, you know, having support groups in the church while people are still accessing care in traditional settings. This project, the Black Church Project, is one that actually provides the evidence-based treatment in the church itself, right? So we take out the traditional setting altogether. And what we were able to find in the pilot, which is the data that we use for the R01, was that not only could we effectively recruit Black adults with severe substance use disorder, that we were able to show a decrease in the use of substances in such a short amount of time, 8 weeks, but also 39 out of 40 people completed it, and were able to gain skills in cognitive behavioral therapy that they could translate into employment. Right. So thinking about the totality, it's not just about a research project. It's about empowering people in order to make changes that will improve their quality of life. Right. And so what we're studying now with the R01 is what we're doing in the Black church. Is it more, less, or equally effective to what happens in traditional settings of care for addiction? So we're going to be recruiting 200 people in New Haven, all Black people with alcohol use disorder and other substances. Shout out to, can we acknowledge that everybody's not just out here using opioids? Like, what about alcohol?
I mean, that's a huge thing is that alcohol,
causes way everywhere. More mortality, morbidity. It's right. Like, we don't want to forget other substances of use just because everybody's focused on opioids. So we focus a lot on alcohol and also cocaine.
Yeah.
So we want to see, by providing treatment in the church setting, can we have better outcomes than traditional settings for addiction? And I think it's going to be a yes, but that's why we have to do the randomized controlled trial. So I am so excited about that. We are going to have a press conference in front of the church, hopefully with the mayor of New Haven, November 5th. So we're super excited about that, to announce the grant. So you heard it first.
We heard it first. And we're not gonna scoop you. We will release it after that.
So we're all good.
You're all good. And I hope to see it on Twitter. But from what I understand, the Imani Breakthrough Project is sort of a support structure for Black people who are going through treatment. And so what this is actually restructuring the treatment itself so that.
Amen. Mm-hmm.
Do I understand that correctly?
You're right on target. That's exactly right. So I'm trying to do it from all angles. One, I want to help you interface in a system that was never built for you, that's inherently racist in and of itself, but I still want you to be able to access care. Until two, which is the NIAAA funded one, let's build the treatment the way that we see fit for us, by us, and see if it works better than the existing options that we have now. And we're going to approach it at both ways and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. We in science, I think generally, in clinical science have, I'll talk about psychology, I guess, specifically. We have a huge implementation problem where we develop all of these great interventions and, you know, we get grants funded and then we just sort of move on and we don't find a way to integrate it into the community. So I guess how do you see this playing out over time? What do you hope happens
and
how to make sure that, you know, assuming that the evidence supports it, in the end that you know, mm-hmm. that it continues.
Yeah, no, that's a great question. Because what you're really asking is how are you creating a system that will outlive mm-hmm. What you're doing at the moment? All right. That's exactly what we want to do is, and we actually wrote this in the grant, is having, depending on what happens with the project, and we're hopeful that will show better outcomes. And if we do, we have a whole system, a whole manual that we've developed where we train what we call church-based health advisors. So these are people within the church structure who have some interest, maybe some clinical or professional background in providing mental health or addiction treatment, but they don't necessarily have to have that. But I'm just saying that from doing the pilot, we were pleasantly surprised to see that there are clinical psychologists in the church.
Right.
There are people who are licensed clinical social workers who really want to be in this space to serve in this role as the church-based health advisors. And we train them over a period of 8 weeks in terms of the basic levels of addiction, principles related to non-stigmatizing language, et cetera, so that what they'll be able to do is implement and follow along and shepherd people through treatment using the computer-based training for cognitive behavioral therapy, which is a computerized program. So they don't have to learn the evidence-based treatment themselves. Hmm. They just have to be able to answer questions or engage with participants who are taking the treatment. And expand to churches all around the country to be able to do this. So it's not necessary for Ayana or another person for Jordan Wellness Collective to be involved in the rollout or the implementation of it, right? So that it can be totally self-sufficient. And what we've been able to find is that people are very willing. There are churches that have whole substance use ministries where they want to be able to help not only parishioners or members of their church, but also in the immediate community to be able to effectively deal or have some impact on people who are using substances. And so this whole training module would be implemented in churches all throughout the country. And we have the infrastructure to be able to do that because we started with a particular nomination of churches who are actually international, but they have a presence in every single state, right? Mm. And so it's an easy way to disseminate information and to make the intervention available to these churches. It's free. But there's a whole training module, so each one teach one, and they can be able to implement it in a way that makes sense for their particular environment, because every church is going to be different, right?
Yeah.
The indeed. Way in which we do the RCT, we have, you know, a few church-based health advisors. Maybe they want more than that. You know, we do it over 8 weeks. Maybe they want to do it longer. I mean, there's adaptations that people can make to have it work for their particular environment, but the nuts and bolts of it are the same. And we're talking about allowing folks to have the freedom to integrate it into their church setting in a way that works. So we're super excited about it.
This is such an awesome project and series of projects, I would say.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons that it's so awesome, aside from all the things you've already talked about, or maybe just to amplify something you already talked about, right, is to build it through the community allows right. it to have the staying power and doesn't require. So a lot of times it's this top down process where we like develop some treatment in like some super like controlled lab coat environment. And then we're like, hey, maybe this will work in the community. Mm-hmm. Right. And that's like buying a couch or buying a house to fit your couch. Right. Like right, shout out Dennis Wendt who said this first, right? Instead, what we want to do is buy a couch that fits your house.
Right.
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 So if you go, if you're already in the house, you know what the dimensions are, what's necessary here, how you want it to look, how you want it to feel. And you can really make sure that the piece that you put in there, right, fits it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. As opposed to trying to come in and be like, oh, how do I get it in? Oh no, I can't even get it through the door. Mm-hmm. Right. So you really belabor this metaphor. Mm-hmm. Right.
And so, but it's a great one though, because it's right on target. I mean, that's exactly right. And, you know, and I love that, that you give credit where credit is due. And I'd like to build on it just a little, the metaphor, but I love it and say, can we go shop for the couch together?
Exactly.
Because we all have different skills. I say, oh, that's a great color, but then somebody else might say, well, what about the texture? Maybe we need cloth, not leather. You know, let's get into it.
Bring all the people who live here
to
shop for a couch that fits your house.
Absolutely. Yes, I love
that. That's how it stays, right? That couch is there to stay now. It's not like somebody else comes in, right? And they're like, ooh.
Right.
Yo, this clashes with what I'm trying to do over here, right? Like, you know what I mean? The rug I have that isn't here yet doesn't match, right? Like whatever's going on, right? Like it just allows it to have staying power.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's super important. And also it's just like, it's anti-racist by nature and affirming, right? And empowering.
Yeah.
Right? Versus like that's like a secondary part of a lot of treatments, right? Like we kind of try to hopefully put some sprinkles on top. Right, to right, and instead that's like built into the fabric of it, and I think that's so huge. And so I just really want to make sure that that our listeners really understand how important this is and how hard and meaningful and important this work is. And so,
and how long it takes, right? So it's like, you know,
this isn't pubs that come out, this ain't five pubs a year
at all. Okay. Yeah. So
right. For anybody who's listening, right?
Like,
you ain't publishing five papers in 1 year on this,
right, in the
middle of it, right? And so I think it's the long game, but it's the important one,
right?
Yeah. So
I think that's really huge.
Yeah.
So thank you so much for sharing some of the stuff. You got Hot Off the Presses coming out. You got your noticeable award.
Yeah.
So if we could pivot for just a second, maybe at the end of our podcast, we like to kind of distill some of the stuff we talked about into some take home messages for our stakeholders that are listening.
Sure.
And so I was wondering if you could perhaps tell us what maybe some take home messages are from your work in this space for we're in recovery.
I appreciate that. I think one of the things that I'm just going to talk to people in recovery, like you said right now, is just really being selfish and asking for what you need in order to protect your recovery. Mm-hmm. And so many of us who have been marginalized are very deferential to the majority culture because we've been socialized to think that white is right, you know, or this way is better, or they might know more than me because they have more degrees or whatever. And so I always say to folks in recovery, you know what you need to do in order to protect your peace. And if you don't know, then you know who you need to get involved to get the help that you need. And so part of it is being unapologetic and protecting your space. And so I realized that's hard to do, and it's hard to do sometimes alone. And for my folks that I know who are in recovery, I say it's okay to get someone to help you to advocate in ways that you might not have been able to develop yet, right? Yeah. So for a lot of people that I know, that means bringing in someone that is part of their social support network, whether that be any mom or a pastor or a priest or whoever from their community that they trust, or maybe just a good friend, to ask the questions, to gain some clarity around recommendations that they might not be sure of, right? Doing all that you can to assert yourself because you're worth it. The world might not treat you as such, but in order for you to really protect your peace, having someone involved in your recovery. So that's what I would say. And the other thing I'll say to someone in recovery, and I'm going to be finished with this, is really thinking about your recovery is your own. No one can tell you what that looks like. And that really upsets me in terms of, oh, yeah, it has to be an abstinent-based recovery. It doesn't. It has to be an MAT-free recovery. It doesn't. You know, maybe you are not using opioids, but you still drink alcohol. If you've never had a problem with alcohol, live your life, right?
Right.
Just not being ashamed of how your recovery looks. It's not a one-size-fits-all model. And if you are engaging with people who are pushing that dogma or that particular point of view, then that's not where you need to be, right? Again, where that advocate can be helpful in terms of, okay, let's look for communities or providers that will be more accepting of what your recovery looks like, for sure. So those are the two things I would say in terms of a takeaway for people in recovery.
Yeah, I mean, those hit hard, because, you know, we spend so much time, and we, the field of addiction, but historically also men, older white men, defining what addiction is, what a recovery is.
Right.
And, you know, when someone is finally ready to walk the road of recovery, whatever that is, it's like, well, they have to give up so many things in order to just jump through the hoops that someone else developed for them. So I think that was, I really loved that. That feedback, I thought it's really important thing to mention. So what about take home messages for practitioners?
For people doing this work, especially practitioners, you have to adopt the anti-racist framework, like, period. And what I mean by that is not just the idea of, like, you know, not being racist, because, like, that's one small step, but actually taking action, right? So working towards deliberate systems and supports to achieve racial equity for everyone. So that requires some level of accountability and action on the side of the practitioner. So it's not okay to just continue on with your usual treatment recommendations. You have to have the anti-racist lens, meaning whatever this treatment that I'm recommending, how might it impact this person differently based on their race? And being very deliberate in going through those steps in your mind. Also, being very clear, what are my own biases based on race in which I might not be treating the person across from me the same as I would someone else from a different race. Just being very clear that we've all been socialized in a racist environment, right? And so we're all, no matter what background we come from, subject to these experiences. And so it's okay to be honest that you might not know how to develop a treatment plan for said person. But it doesn't mean you just keep on doing the same thing.
Right.
You enlist help, right? You say, what are some folks that are doing it better? How can I increase my knowledge about this? What are the systems I can put in place to make it easier for people to want to get treatment from me? So these are the things that practitioners can no longer say, like, I didn't know. You know, because that's the default. Racism is the default. And so if you just approach it as everything you have to do when you're working with someone with addiction is employing an anti-racist framework. And that can even go for white patients. Like, is there a particular way in which I am treating them better or with more privilege than somebody else, you know? How might their culture be influencing care? Like, you have to be very deliberate. So get out of the fear zone, right? Move towards the learning zone. Educate yourself about structural racism. Move towards the growth zone. Do something about it. You have to, an anti-racist movement requires personal action from practitioners. You can't keep saying, teach me. Like, you got here some way, right?
Right.
So you gotta come with that same energy when taking care of patients, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Agreed. I think historically, a lot of times it's been about inaction.
Right.
And what the difference here, I think, from my vantage point is it's about action, no longer staying silent. It's not color blind.
Right.
It's celebrating and understanding, right, differences in power structures and the fabric of racist policies and community movements that have happened throughout our history, and understanding how that informs just simple person-to-person interactions that happen on two chairs in an office somewhere in America today, when we're talking about how addiction impacts a person's life or a family or community, and being an agent of change requires us to act, not be silent.
Yes, exactly.
That's what it's about.
That's it. I mean, if people could just repeat that, we're done. Are you finished? Are you done? We're done.
What would you say to policymakers out there?
You know, I'm working on a project, and we didn't have time to get into it, but it's called the Free Methadone Project. And one of the things that we're doing is understanding what are the perspectives of people with an opioid use disorder who are getting medication from an opioid treatment program. So getting methadone from an opioid treatment program. What are their experiences now that during COVID, they all of a sudden have gone from coming into the clinic 6 days a week to getting 14-day and 28-day take homes, right? And it really has not been studied. No one has looked at what is the experience of someone with an opioid use disorder who has literally had to come in 6 days a week to get medication, and all of a sudden they only have to come in twice a month or once a month.
Right.
What is their perspective? What is the impact of their point of view in terms of how this has negatively or positively impacted their life? And so I give you that little background because it's important that policymakers know you cannot create anti-racist equitable policies if you don't have key stakeholders, i.e. people with addiction or people in recovery from addiction, involved in the cultivation and development of the policy.
Absolutely.
And so they might not have to write the policy, but their point of view has to be included. So when you're looking at something like the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration, who provides the guidelines for methadone administration, why wouldn't you have input from the very people who will receive methadone? It doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
Right. And so you need to be able to have that point of view, whether it be through data collection, which is what we're doing now through our project, or whether it be through written form, but you have to be able to include their point of view. So that's what I'll say, is nothing for us or about us without us. And the us can be whatever group you're trying to make the policy for. The other thing I'll say, but I think that says it all, at least from my point of view, is that historically excluded populations have to be involved in the narrative. And it's dependent upon the policymaker to figure out how they're going to involve them in the narrative, right? And so if you do that, then you're more likely to develop a policy that is inherently just. But if you don't, we'll keep on with the status quo, which is what's happening now in a very broken system where we have health outcomes that are worse now than they were in the 70s.
Yeah. Yeah. So just taking the time to ask.
taking the time to ask or collect data
right.
that has already asked, including those in the decision and the policy making, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's a huge thing with the methadone as well, because, you know, with many of the moral models of addiction, that's why people come in 6 days a week, is because there's a trust, you know, an inherent trust issue with our policies. And there's almost been this forced natural experiment.
Right. Exactly.
Which is really interesting. It's sort of a, you know, we could go down a rabbit hole, but you know, your work, much of what we talked about has implications for historically excluded populations. But it, you know, if there was something maybe you haven't said, or you want to emphasize that, that is a specific take home message for people who identify with historically excluded populations.
Yeah, thank you. I always say, I truly mean this, is I love you. The world might not love you. The world might not see you or value you, but you do have value. And I want to work collaboratively with you in order for you to maximize your value, right? And so don't be dismayed. Expect that you're going to be navigating a system that doesn't understand your brilliance, may not affirm your excellence, but yet you can persevere and you will persevere. And in order to do that, you might just need to enlist some help, and that is okay. But it's worth it in the end. So again, the same thing I said in terms of talking to the people in recovery, you have to be unapologetic and protecting who you are. And if you can't do that for yourself all the time, because it's difficult, given how beat up you have been, especially in this country, find somebody who can advocate for you. And sometimes those people may look like you and sometimes they won't, right? And that's okay. But as long as they have your interests in mind, and you can communicate and they listen to you, get that help for sure. Because even as I think about this podcast, like, you guys are allowing a space and a platform for people to learn how to do better, right? And to think about how they can take care of underserved populations better. So it doesn't always have to come in the package of somebody looking like you, but just know that it's okay for you to accept help from them if they have your best interest in mind. So that's what I'll say. It's tough though, it's rough. I mean, I really want to not end this podcast without acknowledging Walter Wallace Jr., you know, who was killed by police in Philadelphia, in the middle of a mental health crisis. And so I have to acknowledge the reality of how hard it is for people from underserved populations to get the care they need. And yet we still have to persevere in some way, right? And so finding those people who can advocate for you is of the utmost importance. But he's been on my heart. His family has been on my heart. And I just grieve alongside the folks in Philadelphia, because that was another huge loss.
Yeah, absolutely. It's exhausting.
Yeah.
It's been going on for decades. This year has been, I think, as a young white man, it's been really eye-opening this year for me. And, you know, I hear you. And I appreciate the pain and the suffering. And I hope we can all do better. I look, you know, to a future, I hope that where some of these issues have been resolved.
Yeah, that's all we can do, right? Is just to do better and actively work, right? It's not just happenstance. We have to work to build a better society in which we live. And so I appreciate that for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, agreed. Agreed. I think it's a natural, it's like a obvious outgrowth of racist policies historically that police respond to the situation, mm-hmm. right? That like there could be a different way, right? And yeah. and I encourage policymakers or any of the people who are listening to this that have says in the types of things that we create systems that are equitable for situations like this, where you're having a mental health crisis, that maybe a mobile mental health crisis team would right. be the people who come versus right. guns drawn police.
Right. For people who may not be able to see your humanity. Like, why can't exactly. members of the community respond to an exactly. crisis?
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I'm really glad you brought that up. We can't just allow those things. Again, it's, we can't be silent. Right. Yeah. And so I'm really right. want to make sure that you hear how important it was that you brought that up. Yeah. I'm really grateful for that.
You've been really successful. You know, there are a lot of people out there that could use some advice. And what kind of trainee advice do you have for people trying to move up in the field?
Samuel, I love that you think that I've been so successful. And I think that I have had some element of success, but maybe catch me in like 20 years and see what's going on. And I think then you can tell
me. Oh, I can't imagine then. I mean, it's going to be, yeah.
Yeah, no, but I have, you know, I think about this often because people do ask me this question, and it's nothing too like much of a heavy hitter message, but I do want to say this because these are things that have been super important in my life. One, a collection of mentors. Not everybody can serve one role, but you have to have at least one mentor that believes in you more than you believe in yourself. And your ability to navigate this very racist, sexist community that we call science. That's the reality. And so you need someone in your corner that understands that and can help you navigate, especially if you're from one of those identities who have been excluded. Don't be afraid to ask around who has an awesome track record. It's more than just their science. It's more than their H index. It is who can see the humanity in you, believes in you, and can push you to be just amazing. And for me, that's Kathy Carroll, who's a white woman. Shout out to Kathy. She's been tremendous. So finding that mentor is important. Secondly, because this happened in my own life, and I see so many people who are stuck in a rut and they just continue to do it because they think they have to. Don't be afraid to chart a new path if you genuinely are not happy. The field in the pursuit of a terminal degree is tough. So we know that that's going to happen. But if you genuinely wake up depressed, anxious, or not motivated by your work, then it's okay to chart a new course. Doesn't mean you have to leave the field altogether, but perhaps you need to figure out a different topic, yeah. or you need to think about a different mechanistic way to go about solving that problem or issue. It's okay. Have the courage to chart a new path. And the last thing I'll say is really taking a break for your own psychological wellness. I used to always think, oh, self-care, let me get a mani-pedi, all these things. But I'm just saying, and that's great. Like, I love getting my nails and feet done. But it's important for you to have space to develop other things in your life that you're whole, right? Whether that be, you know, meditation. I love doing trap yoga or Reiki. But doing whatever you need to do for your own self-preservation. And one of my favorite quotes is by Audre Lorde. She says, caring for myself is not self-indulgence. It is self-preservation. That is an act of political warfare. So self-preservation in and of itself makes a political statement, and being sure to do that and making space. And if people don't respect that, then that's not where you need to be.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ayanna Jordan. Go look up her work, her papers. Go look at, watch her videos. She's got talks on YouTube. She's been delivering talks like crazy.
So yeah.
at least it feels to me at least like once a week. It's really awesome. She's passionate and she's doing really, really awesome work. It's an honor to have you on the podcast, and just thank you for your time.
Yeah, no, it's been great to hang out with you guys. It's like we're just chit-chatting around the fireside. So I just love it.
Hey, it's that time of year, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's been a wonderful way to pass the time, and I'm really honored to be on your guys' podcast. So thanks for having me, for sure.
Absolutely.
Next month on the Addiction Psychologist podcast, we're going to be talking with Dr. Adam Leventhal. Adam is a professor in the Department of Preventative Medicine and Psychology at the University of Southern California. He's the director of the USC Institute for Addiction Science, and he is a recently anointed member of the Tobacco Products Scientific Advisory Committee for the FDA. He's going to be coming on to talk to us about vaping, what we know about vaping, and specifically among adolescent populations. Make sure to tune in.